Our guest this hour is a philosopher and the author of the book, Would You Kill the Fat Man? I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The book is about trolleyology and the iconic ethical dilemma known as the trolley problem. And we want to know what you would do. Would you make a decision to kill one innocent person if it meant you would save the lives of multiple innocent people? We will run through the different variations of the trolley problem, talk about how this applies to real life, and what it says about right and wrong. And we will welcome your questions and your answers to trolley problem questions. And I would like you to call in right now and maybe you can play along. 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org if you have a question that you'd like to pose, but you can't really play along with our guest asking you questions about the trolley problem unless you call in. So call in if you would like to take part in this. Let me welcome our guest. I'm very happy to have with us David Edmondson. He is co-founder of the Philosophy Bites podcast. He is the author most recently of Would You Kill the Fat Man? The Trolley Problem and What Your Answer Tells Us About Right and Wrong. And David Edmondson joins us from NPR's BBC Studios in London. I'm sorry, it's Edmonds, not Edmondson. Edmonds. Hello, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, delighted to be here.
Well, let's first of all, and we do have a lot of callers who are going to join us to play the trolley problem. But essentially, what exactly is the trolley problem?
Well, there are lots of trolley problems, as you suggested. The essential trolley problem is this. You imagine the first scenario, which is that a train is going down a track and it's out of control. Its brakes have failed. And ahead of the train are five people tied to the track. And it looks like the train will kill the five people if you do nothing. Fortunately, there is something that you can do. You're standing by the side of the track. You can turn a switch, and the switch will turn the train down a spur, down a sidetrack, which is good news because you'll save the five lives. But the bad news is that there is one person tied to that sidetrack. So if you turn the train, that one person will be killed. So that's the first trolley problem. And obviously, the question to you is, well, what would you do? Would you turn the train or not?
All right. Well, I'm not going to answer it because I do want a listener to play this and then because I know there's a different variation and sometimes the answers might be different. So I'm gonna bring Charlie in Milwaukee on the air to see if Charlie, are you going to play this with us?
Sure.
All right. So I'm sorry, David Edmonds. Please present variation number one to Charlie.
So variation number one is what I just gave you. So the second scenario is this. This time the train is out of control. It is once again heading down the track. It's going to kill five people. Once again, you can save five lives. But the way you do it this time is that you're standing on a footbridge overlooking the track. And next to you is a very large man, a fat man. And he's leaning over the footbridge, let's say. You can give him a gentle little tumble and he'll fall down and splatter on the track below. But his sheer bulk will stop the train from hitting the five people. So the first variation on the one I presented earlier is that. Would you push the fat man to save the five lives?
All right. So, Charlie, would you push the fat man onto the track to save the five lives?
I think I would, with the caveat that I would say to the fat man, I am going to push you on here with the whole idea that you're going to save five lives. I think getting his assent to something does a lot towards mitigating the guilt of doing something like this. I think doing it without telling him, because since you're right there and you're able to talk to him about it, has a big thing. I think a big thing would be talking to the people and letting them know what you're doing.
Interesting. So what would you do if you were just to flip a switch and change the track of the train? Would you do that? Would you flip the switch to kill one person tied to the tracks in order to save five people who are tied on the other track?
I would, but I'd feel a lot more guilty, and I don't think I could defend my move as much as if I had said to the fat person, hey, I'm saving five people and pushing them in.
So what do you make of that, David?
Well, that's an interesting response. The philosopher, of course, can make these abstract, hypothetical examples just as he or she pleases and can set the conditions. And the condition in the classic fat man scenario is that you have no time to ask the fat man. You can't ask his permission. You have to push him to save the five lives. There's no time to engage in any kind of conversation with him. Of course, if you did have time and he was prepared to kill himself, well, it seems pretty clear that you wouldn't be doing anything very immoral, not least because presumably he could jump himself. And in fact, the reason why the fat man has to be fat is because if you yourself could save the five people by jumping off the footbridge, well, that's clearly the moral thing to do, because you could sacrifice yourself and save the five lives. But the way the scenario is set up is you can't kill yourself because you're just not fat enough. So the fat man has to be fatter than you are, and it's his bulk that has to be the one that is able to stop the train. So in the scenario as it's set up, I'm afraid you can't talk to the fat man. You can't ask his permission. All you can do is push him without engaging in any conversation at all.
Well, you know, and our caller fell off, so we don't have him to now answer that. But we do have Michael in River Falls, who was going to offer that he would sacrifice himself. But now, given this, Michael, now that we know that you cannot save the people by sacrificing yourself because you're not big enough, now what do you do? Would you push the fat man onto the tracks? You can't ask him permission either.
I would either do nothing, or else I would push the fat man or flip the switch.
You would either do nothing. So you would, what would you do? You got a split second. You would do nothing, or you'd push the fat man.
Oh, I thought the flip switch part. Push the fat man, I guess.
Yeah. All right. So a lot of people say that they would be able to flip the switch easily enough and kill one person as opposed to killing five. But a lot of people have a much harder time saying that they would push the fat man onto the tracks. Isn't that right, David?
Right. So the stats show that they've asked this question to people all around the world. And the stats show that 90% of people in the first case are prepared to flick the switch to kill the one person on the spur to save the five lives. But the stats are completely the reverse for the fat man. So 90% of people won't push the fat man to save the five lives. And so the puzzle at the heart of the book is, what is it about those two cases that elicits such different reactions? Are we being rational in drawing a distinction between those two cases? And it's a puzzle that goes back 50 years in the philosophical literature, and philosophers still argue now and puzzle about what it is that makes those two cases so distinct.
Well, it is. It is fascinating to think about it. I will say that my initial reaction to these two different scenarios was the same, that yes, I would flip the switch to divert the train to kill the one person as opposed to the five, but I couldn't push the fat man onto the tracks, and I think it was because I physically would have to push the fat man, and it seems so much more intentionally homicidal. I don't know, that you're actually physically pushing someone to their death seemed worse, and that factors into some people's decision there, doesn't it?
Yeah, there's a lot of evidence about all these kinds of decisions that people will take in these trolley scenarios, and your reaction is common. So I think there is an element that people are squeamish about actually pushing somebody, using their muscles. And they've done tests on this, and it does seem to be a factor which is dissuading people from pushing the fat man. There are numerous trolley scenarios. Here's another trolley scenario which gets around that problem. So imagine now that the trolley is racing towards the five people who are going to die. They're stuck on the track and the train is out of control. This time, you're not on the footbridge. You're standing, as you were in the first scenario, by the side of the track. And there's another way in which you can save the five lives. The fat man is still up on the footbridge. This time, all you have to do is turn a little switch. There's no pushing. There's no muscle involvement. It's exactly the same finger movement as there was in the first scenario. And by turning a switch, you can drop the fat man through the footbridge. And once again, the fat man will splatter onto the track below and stop the train from killing the five. So you've been saved from any physical involvement with the fat man. And what the studies suggest is that more people are willing to do that than actually push the fat man. So that does seem to have an effect, but it's only a relatively small effect. So it's still the case that even in that scenario, where it's once again just a question of turning a switch, many more people are more reluctant to kill the fat man than they are to turn the switch in the first scenario to direct it down the spur.
Yeah, I'd still be reluctant to do that. And why is that? Can you tell me why?
Well, the book is the philosophical section of the book is trying to get to grips with that, and there are lots of different explanations. My own theory is that it has something to do with the doctrine of double effects that maybe we can talk about later, but it's to do with the fact that when you divert the train in the first case, you are not using the one person as a means to an end. Whereas in the second case, with the fat man, you are. Now, let me explain what I mean. Imagine that you divert the train in the first case to down the sidetrack. And miraculously, that one person, it's not going to happen, but miraculously, that one person was able to extricate himself from the tracks and to run away. What would your reaction be? Well, your reaction would be absolute delight. You've diverted the train, you've saved the five lives, and you haven't had to kill one person because the one person has escaped. Now think about the fat man. You've pushed the fat man over. Let's say he's wearing a rubber suit and he bounces off the track and he runs away and he's completely unharmed. But what happens now is that the train races on and kills the five people. So you need the death of the fat man. You need the fat man to be on the track to save the five lives. So it looks like there's a difference between how you're using the fat man in the second case and the first scenario where you're just diverting the train but not using the one person on the sidetrack.
We are talking with David Edmonds. He is author of Would You Kill the Fat Man? The Trolley Problem and What Your Answer Tells Us About Right and Wrong. And we welcome your answers to these various trolley variations, and we welcome your questions. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page, or you can tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We are talking with David Edmonds. He is a philosopher. He is the author of Would You Kill the Fat Man? The Trolley Problem and What Your Answer Tells Us About Right and Wrong. And we welcome your questions and your answers. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Boy, we have a lot of people who want to talk a little bit more about what they would do. So let's do that first before we go into some other areas like how this applies to real life. Al in Appleton is with us. Hi, Al.
Good morning, Joy. Thanks for the show. I just want to say in the scenarios that you presented, I personally would not take any action that would harm another person if there was a way for me to jump down, stop the train, or even attempt to stop the train knowing that my bulk isn't enough. I might still attempt that, but I wouldn't take action to put someone else, to make that choice for someone else.
Yeah, even if it meant flipping a switch to take the life of one as opposed to five. If you do nothing, five will die.
Yeah, I would not flip the switch, but I can see why a lot of people would do a switch but not touch the person, push the fat man, because that personal touch, I think, delivers a higher degree of guilt. And if I could, I would ask one question. Is the premise of the book or the author that five lives are intrinsically more valuable than one?
David?
Very good question. Yeah, that is absolutely the premise. That the premise is if you're not doing anything morally wrong by taking the one life, then certainly it's better to save five lives than to save one life. I mean, there are these various scenarios where, let's say in triage, where a doctor arrives at an accident and can go in one direction where he or she can save five lives, or go in another direction where he or she can only save one life. And of course, for the emergency services, that there's no issue about what they should do. They should go in the direction in which they save the most lives. That's a slightly different scenario because in the trolley scenario that I set up, the train is heading towards five people. So you actually have to do something to shift its direction. But the premise is absolutely, as you suggest, that given the choice, if the doctor has the choice between going left and saving five lives and going right and saving one life, it would be quite wrong to flick a switch and choose, on a 50-50 basis to save the one or save the five. What the doctor should do, given the choice between saving five and saving one, is save five.
Yeah, and you, David, say that you would not kill the fat man. Why not?
Well, for the reasons that I suggested in my last answer, that you're using the fat man as a means to an end. I think it has something to do with a distinction that many people make in warfare, that US presidents, UK prime ministers make in warfare. When they try and draw a distinction, you know, Prime Minister Blair and President Bush did this, of course, a lot between what Britain and America were doing when they go to war in Iraq and what Al-Qaeda is doing. And the distinction they make, which I think is a perfectly valid one, is that the Brits or Americans might launch a military attack on a military installation, knowing that 100, let's say, civilians who are living around that military installation might die because they're living very close and they're bound to be caught in that terrible euphemism, collateral damage. And nonetheless, they carry out that operation because they want to attack the military installation or they want to attack the Al-Qaeda headquarters or whatever. There's a difference between that, they claim, and the way Al-Qaeda might behave, which is to deliberately target civilians, deliberately aim to kill, let's say, 100 civilians. So if you're looking just at the numbers, Al-Qaeda and Bush and Blair, in a hypothetical scenario, you can imagine that in both cases, 100 civilians are going to be killed. Nonetheless, there's a moral distinction between those two types of operations, I think, because if the Brits and Americans genuinely aren't intending to kill the civilians, that makes a moral difference in the operation.
Of course, that made me think of what if the five guys on the track that the train is racing toward are Al-Qaeda, and the one person on the other track is an innocent civilian.
Yes, you can flip your intuitions in numerous different ways. You could also imagine that the one person on the track, I don't know, or the five people on the track are about to find a cure for cancer, or the one person on the track is about to find a cure for cancer, or the one person on the track is Einstein. There was various ways of changing one's intuition. You could also imagine that the five are of different ages, and the one person might be a child and the five might be very elderly people. There's all sorts of ways of changing one's intuitions. I guess that these trolley problems tend not to go into those kind of distinctions because they're looking at something else. They're trying to work out what the distinction is between those two cases where those other factors aren't involved. It first arose because the woman who came up with this problem first, who was a British philosopher who was actually the granddaughter, as I describe in the book of President Grover Cleveland, although she was British, her mother was American. Her mother was actually born in the White House. And she became the granddaughter became a philosopher, Philippa Foot. And she was interested in this first trolley case where it seems okay to turn the train. And she compared it to an imaginary case in hospital where you imagine that five people are in desperate need of transplants, and that happens in the real world, of course, all the time. People die because there are no transplants available. And you imagine there are five people who are going to die unless they get their transplants, and there are two people who need lung transplants, there are two people who need kidney transplants, and there's one person who needs a heart transplant. And a sick person walks into the hospital, and this person has got a minor ailment, and the doctors could treat this person, and then that person would go home and would be absolutely fine and would live a long and happy life. But what you could do as a doctor is give this guy a bop on the head and kill him, basically, and take his organs and save the five people. Now, I think most people, your listeners may disagree, maybe in Wisconsin there's a different attitude to this, but I think most people around the world would think that would be wrong. That's not something you should do. And Philippa Foot was interested in the difference between that case, the hospital case, and the first case where it looks like it's okay to turn the train and change its direction to save the five people.
I think we're probably similar to the rest of the world on that one. But let's go to Angie in Oshkosh. Hi, Angie.
Hi. I think what I would do is probably freeze because I would panic and be too indecisive to make a decision on time. But I feel like there is a difference between the Batman and the switching the track, and I feel like it's because the guy on the track is already kind of destined for death and or more destined for death than the Fat Man, and the Fat Man's like not in any danger before you do something, whereas like you're just like making one degree of difference for the guy on the track. I don't know.
Yeah, well, I have to admit that crossed my mind to some extent, too, and I'm not sure exactly why, but this person's in the danger already. Why put somebody else in the danger? What about that?
I think that's a very good point and a very interesting distinction. And, again, I do talk about that as a possible solution to this. So it does look like perhaps you could argue that in the first case, you've got an ongoing threat, and all you're doing is nudging it in a different direction, where that's the spur case. Whereas in the second case, the Fat Man case, there's no ongoing threat to the Fat Man. You're introducing a whole new threat. I can try and explain why I think that's wrong. And this is an example from a Harvard philosopher. There are lots of trolleyologists about that around the world who spend a lot of time coming up with these often quite bizarre trolley scenarios. And she imagines that the trolley is going along down a track and it's going to kill five people who this time are lying on a Lazy Susan. You know, one of those revolving plates that you get at Chinese restaurants and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And you can revolve it 180 degrees. But if you do that, there's a fat man on exactly the opposite side of the Lazy Susan, and the train will now kill the fat man, and the fat man will be killed rather than the five who were on the revolving Susan. Now, what's interesting about that case is it looks like, again, she thinks that most people's intuitions would be, well, it's okay to turn the revolving plate so that the fat man gets killed. But here's a case where the fat man, you're not redirecting the threat. You're redirecting the target, as it were. So it looks like your caller who came up with that interesting distinction, it looks like that might not be at the heart of it. One thing to say about these cases is that we have these very strong intuitions about what we should do, but we don't know why we have these intuitions. And that's a fascinating aspect of morality. And I have a chapter in the book about this, but there's a parallel has been drawn between morality and language. So Chomsky, who's at MIT, famously came up with the idea that all languages have in common a deep universal grammar, and that's how it is that children are able to pick up languages so quickly and construct sentences in in ways that they've never heard before. And it may well be that morality is a bit like that as well, that humans have a deep universal moral grammar all around the world. We share this deep universal moral grammar. And another parallel between language and morality is that if I ask you why you say a particular sentence in the English language, why you say a big blue elephant and not a blue big elephant, well, you probably don't know, or rather, if you do know, you have to think about it a bit. Mm-hmm. You'd have to reflect on why it is you follow the rules that you do, and that size comes before colour when you're talking about nouns. But it's not something that we kind of immediately know. It's not something at the foremost of our consciousness. We have to reflect on it. And that's the same with morality and these trolley cases. We have these strong intuitions, and yet it involves a great deal of thought trying to deconstruct them in our minds and try to work out actually what is going on and what is driving our intuitions.
Let's take another call from John in Madison. Hi, John.
Good morning.
Morning. Good morning. Go ahead. Do you have any? What would you do?
I would lean towards doing nothing, because once you touch the mechanics of the apparatus, you become part of the murder scenario.
What about doing nothing at all?
I think it is the case that, of course, if you were to push the fat man in real life, there have been very few fat man cases in real life. But if you mm-hmm. were to push the fat man, I think you would be done for murder. Just last week, I went into a virtual laboratory moral cave. Now, this is a laboratory where you're in 3D and you're wearing these goggles and you move around and the images move around in front of you. And it's as though you're in a kind of real world. And various trolley scenarios were presented to me. And it's very realistic. Somebody started shooting. I wasn't expecting it. And my heart started palpitating. And in fact, it took me quite a long time to do anything. And I know these trolley scenarios back to front. So if anybody reacts quickly about these scenarios, it should be me, because I know kind of what I think about them, what I think you should do. But it did take me quite a long time to respond. And I was overtaken by panic. So I think actually psychologically that would in fact happen to a lot of people. They would be paralyzed and they wouldn't be able to make a decision.
Right. That's what I was thinking too. John in Richland Center is with us. Hi, John. What would you do?
Good morning. Interesting. I would do nothing, because my grandfather was a philosopher too. And just like Winston Churchill sent 200,000 troops to the beaches for a good cause, to fight the Germans, I would just call it fate. They know that many of them were not coming back.
Well, John would resort to fate.
Well, I think you've cited the wrong authority there, because I begin by talking about Winston Churchill and a case which was in the literature, but I've dug out some more details about it. And it's a real-life case, and it was in 1944 when the V-1 missiles were being sent over from the European continent to mainland Britain by the Nazis. And the Nazis were trying to kill as many people as they could to try and dampen morale, and they were aiming for the centre of London, the most densely populated part of London. But the missiles, the V-1 missiles, were falling short. And they were falling slightly to the south of the centre, to districts like Peckham and Lambeth and so on, if anybody knows London. And so killing fewer people than the Nazis intended to kill. There were a load of double agents who were working for the British, although the Nazis thought they were working for the Nazis. And the dilemma arose as follows. The Secret Services wondered whether they should use the double agents to send back misinformation, disinformation, back to the Nazis, to tell the Nazis that, in fact, the missiles were landing in the centre of London, or indeed that they were landing to the north of the centre, hoping that the Nazis would adjust the trajectory of the missiles so that they would fall even further south and kill even fewer people. And there was a dispute in the British cabinet between the war minister and the prime minister, Winston Churchill, about what they should do. And the war minister took exactly the position of your latest caller, saying, it's not our role to play God. We can't choose who lives and who dies. And Winston Churchill took the view that I think was the morally correct view, and which is very parallel to the first trolley case I talked about, where you can turn the train down the track to kill the one to save the five. Winston Churchill said, no, we should carry out this operation and try and persuade the Nazis that they're hitting the centre of town. And the operation was indeed carried out. We don't know the effect of that operation, but what we do know is that the Nazis never changed the trajectory of those missiles, and that they never became more accurate. And there's one estimate that by falling south rather than by falling in the centre of town, several thousand lives were saved. And so if Winston Churchill had an impact in saving several thousand lives, I think he was quite right to do that and to carry out that operation.
Thank you, John, for the call. Nancy emails, I think these sorts of exercises are useful in starting us thinking, but real life seldom offers such dilemmas. What would I do? I would measure time and look for other options. Are there people on the train? That's a good question, but Nancy's wasting some time there, too. What about that, David?
Another good objection, I think. It is another good objection. And I discuss quite a lot about how useful these are and the critique that, although they're wonderfully good fun and intellectually extremely challenging, that they tell us nothing about the real world because the real world is very messy. And I think my response to that, of course, I wouldn't have written the whole book if I didn't think they were both interesting and did tell us something about the real world. My response is that the whole point of these thought experiments is to clear up a messy world. It's precisely because the world is so messy, and in the real world, there are 100 different factors that are influencing us and affecting our intuitions quite rightly. What we need is a thought experiment to try and extract all this white noise, all this mess, and to try and get to a pure hypothetical case where we can see what kind of moral principles we should be following and what kind of principles we should jettison.
We are talking with David Edmonds. He is author of Would You Kill the Fat Man? The Trolley Problem and What Your Answer Tells Us About Right and Wrong. We welcome your questions about trolleyology. We also welcome your answers to these various trolley problem variations. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. If you're just joining us, imagine a runaway train racing toward five men who are tied to the tracks. You can divert the train by flipping a switch to send the train down a set of tracks that has one man tied to the tracks. So your decision would kill one person but save five people. What would you do? Would your answer be different if you could save those five men tied to the tracks by instead pushing a large fat man onto the tracks? And it's a fat man because it's supposed to be a large person that's going to stop the train, thus killing the man that you pushed, but stopping the train and saving the five people that are on the track. So you can call in with your answers or your questions about right and wrong. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We are talking with David Edmonds. He is co-founder of the Philosophy Bites podcast and author most recently of Would You Kill the Fat Man? The Trolley Problem and What Your Answer Tells Us About Right and Wrong. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Our next caller is Bruce in Holman. Hi, Bruce.
Hello, good morning. Earlier listening, I was thinking about the science fiction author Isaac Asimov, who wrote many science fiction novels about interactions between robots and humans. He came up with the three laws of robotics, and the first of those laws is that a robot may not injure a human being or, through inaction, allow a human being to come to harm. And it seems like this trolley situation would probably give a robot a really hard time because it's kind of a you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't, and how would a machine deal with that? But also I was thinking about the physicist who came up with a thought experiment in quantum physics known as Schrodinger's cat, wherein a cat is put in a sealed container with a poisonous gas, and according to quantum physics, you cannot know whether the cat is alive or dead until you open the box and observe it. Quantum physics say that the cat is actually both alive and dead at the same time. So in the case of the trolley scenario, I would turn my back and walk away, because as long as I didn't observe and know the outcome of the situation, everyone either survived or all perished. So I guess ignorance is bliss in that case, according to quantum physics.
Oh, a reaction to that, David?
Yeah, I'm not sure about the Schrodinger cat connection, because I think the point about I'm no quantum physicist. The point about that is that it only works at a quantum level. Somebody will be killed and somebody will be saved, whether or not you turn your back or not. So. The point about Schrodinger cat is it's a question of probability, whereas in the trolley cases, definitely somebody will die and definitely some people will be saved. But the earlier point about the robotics is fascinating that Bruce raised. At the moment, most robots in war, one thinks of the drones that are currently flying over Pakistan and elsewhere. Most of the drones are operated from the deserts of Nevada. They're operated by human beings. But at some stage in the not-too-distant future, we're going to get Google-less cars and driverless cars and so on. At some stage, these robots, these machines, are going to begin to make autonomous in inverted commas, decisions for themselves. And then the machines have to be programmed to respond to precisely these dilemmas. So the programs have to know what to do if they're faced with a choice between one life or two lives, for example. And at that stage, it's not a question of pure calculation. We have to build in some moral theory into the robot. We have to decide whether the robot is a utilitarian, whether, in other words, all that matters are the consequences, all that matters is how many lives are saved. Or we have to decide whether there are human rights, that there are some things that you can't do to human beings, whatever the consequences. And so we're going to face this problem, probably not in the too distant future, about what kind of moral code to build into our robots, and whether we're going to, they're going to be Aristotelian, whether they're going to be Kantian, whether they're going to be utilitarian, because it's no longer, they're no longer going to be operated from human beings. They're going to have to make these decisions for themselves.
Thank you, Bruce. We go now to Richard in Milwaukee. Hello, Richard.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just think it's interesting that the subject we're talking about is a fat man as opposed to a fat woman. And I also think, because maybe the answer would be different, but the main point I wanted to make is, what if it were a 280-pound, very fit linebacker of the National Football League that I have a choice to, or a 180-pound, wonderful, bodybuilding female specimen that I have to push over, because they're considerably heavier than I am and have a much greater likelihood. In other words, a very beautiful person as opposed to a fat person, a female as opposed to a male. I think we're predisposing the answerer by it being a fat man or even a 190-pound, very fit soccer player from England.
Oh, I think these are great points, Richard, but would you react differently to a bodybuilding woman or an NFL football player in terms of having to push them off?
Sure I would, because they're a gorgeous physical specimen. Sure I would. Most people would. Of course I would.
But I think the point there, though, is that you're assuming that the fat man is an ugly, fat, overweight man. But even if that's the case, the point about the fat man scenario is that people won't push him over. 90% of people won't push him over. So they can hardly be even more reluctant to push the person over if it's a beautiful male or female person on the bridge. They already are reluctant to push the fat man over. So it's not that is deterring them. That doesn't look like it's going to be a factor. You're right, of course, that by, as Joy was saying earlier, you can change one's intuitions by giving identities to these people, by changing whether they're male or female. To some extent, it changes people's views, but actually to a very little extent. So there's a very interesting study, I think, that was carried out. It was carried out somewhere in the States, I can't remember where they did this exact study, and they gave the person on the bridge a name. And in the one scenario, they gave the fat man a stereotypical white name. I think it was, I can't remember what it was, Chester Fox the Third or something. I can't remember. And in the second case, they gave the person a stereotypical black name. And the results were fascinating there, because once again, there was a considerable reluctance to push the fat man. But with conservatives, I thought this was quite a counterintuitive result. With conservatives, I guess Republicans, there was no difference to whether they would push the person with the stereotypical white name and the person with the stereotypical black name, whereas bizarrely the liberals, I guess the more democratic leaning segment of the population, were more likely to push the stereotypical white name than they were the black name. Make of that what you will.
Richard, thank you for the call. Brian in Milwaukee. Hi, Brian.
Yeah, hi. How are you? I've been a listener for a long time, and it's just kind of interesting to listening to this audience and how few people in our audience really want to step up and take responsibility, which I kind of thought was kind of interesting. Because to me, it would seem like a very easy decision to make, even if you had to physically push this person to save five. But what I thought was interesting was just listening to how few people are willing to step up, you know.
Yeah. So Brian would kill the fat man, David.
Yeah, Brian's very unusual. And I wouldn't kill the fat man. And I'd like to think it's not because I'm not prepared to step up. I'd like to believe I wouldn't kill the fat man because sometimes the utilitarian solution, the mere crunching of the numbers, is not the right way to go. So another way of thinking about this is in the torture debate. Sometimes one can imagine that one could torture somebody to save a few lives. Let's say one could torture a quite innocent person. Let's not go too much into the details of the case, but imagine you could torture a perfectly innocent person to save a few lives. Well, if Brian is right, then stepping up to the plate means it's right to torture that person. You should think about how many lives you should save. But in fact, most of us don't think that's the right way to go. We think that we have certain rights. One of those rights is the right not to be tortured, especially if one is entirely innocent. So the mere fact that it would save more lives by being tortured isn't necessarily the definitive evidence that we need that is acceptable.
Yeah. So how do we accept that? Let's say 100 people will perish in the bomb that explodes that the bad guy planted. How do we justify those people dying if we could have roughed up this guy to find out where that bomb was?
Well, I think it's much more complicated if we're talking about roughing up the guilty party, him or herself. So we still have laws about what you can do with the person, the bad guy, who has planted the bomb. And in fact, there was a case in Germany, which I discuss, where there was two kids. There was a kid missing, and it looked like this guy knew where the kid was, and they thought the only way they could save the kid was by threatening to torture the guy who had kidnapped him. And they did threaten to torture him, and they were subsequently punished, the police, for taking that action. So, I mean, most democracies have rules against how you can treat even the bad guy. But it's obviously more complicated if it's the bad guy, because you might argue, some moral philosophers have argued, that if you're a bad guy and if you've kidnapped somebody, if you've killed, if you're threatening to kill other people, then you no longer have the rights to be defended yourself. I mean, I think that's dodgy territory to get into. But the more interesting case is if the person is completely innocent, because that's more akin to the trolley cases.
Yeah.
And most people in those cases don't think that it's okay to kill an innocent person to save other lives. Equally, you can imagine cases where there might be a riot in which lots of people are killed unless you frame an innocent man and put an innocent man in jail. Most people, once again, think, well, even if you are going to save a riot and save lives, justice requires that you only punish the guilty, and that's not something that you should do.
Boy, we very little time and lots of people still wanting to get in on this. Let me share Steve on Facebook, who says, it seems to me that the ultimate real-life situation related to this scenario is the dropping of the bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
Yes, I think that's absolutely right. And there's a woman who writes about this and related problems called Elizabeth Anscombe, who was Wittgenstein, the great 20th century philosopher, Wittgenstein's literary executor and a great philosopher in her own right. And when President Truman was going to be given an honorary doctorate by Oxford University, she organized a campaign, completely unsuccessfully, to prevent him getting his honorary doctorate on the grounds that he had dropped those bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki and that he had intentionally killed innocent people. I think that is right, that dropping bombs like that, intentionally killing hundreds of thousands, if not these days potentially millions of people, is indeed completely morally unacceptable.
Well, so in our final moments here, what is the takeaway? How can people use the trolley problem in real life problem solving?
Well, I think the point about these trolley problems is that they're very useful in a whole range of real-life moral issues. So they're linked in some ways to discussions about abortion. They're linked to a whole set of issues in medical ethics. And I've mentioned a couple of times that they're linked to issues about warfare and how we should behave in warfare. It's very interesting that in West Point, and I've been to see it in operation, all the future officers are taught the fat man scenario and the difference between the fat man and the spur case and what that difference might be as a way to get them to think about how they themselves should behave in conflict.
Well, we'll leave it there. Thank you very much for being with us. This was really thought-provoking. We appreciate your time.
I've enjoyed it. Thanks for having me.
David Edmonds is co-founder of the Philosophy Bites podcast. He is a Oxford philosopher, and he is the author of Would You Kill the Fat Man? The Trolley Problem and What Your Answer Tells Us About Right and Wrong. And he joined us from NPR's BBC studios in London. Thanks to Christy Taylor for producing and directing this program. Thanks to Marika Saval for on-air production. Thank you for listening. I hope you stay tuned. There's much more to come. Coming up in our next hour, it's On Point, and you'll hear arguments for and against Obamacare coming up after 9 o'clock. And tomorrow at this time, it's our Week in Review. We'll have two guests from different political viewpoints talking with you about the top political news stories of the week. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.